Welcome to Friday and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. I don't suppose you caught a little convention from Philly this week. Here is a little trip down memory lane.
What does it take to be the first female anything? It takes grit and it takes grace.
This November, when we go to the polls, that is what we're deciding. Not Democrat or Republican, not left or right. No, in this election and every election is about who will have the power to shape our children for the next 4 or 8 years of their lives.
And I move that Hillary Clinton be selected as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
In the spring of 1971, I met a girl. We've been walking and talking and laughing together ever since.
We're gonna build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, believe me. We're gonna destroy ISIS so fast, believe me. There's nothing suspicious in my tax returns, believe me.
That's why anyone who threatens our values, whether fascists or communists or jihadists or homegrown demagogues, will always fail in the end. This is my
fight song. Take that. So let's be stronger together, my fellow Americans. Let's look to the future with courage and confidence. Let's build a better tomorrow for our beloved children and our beloved country. And when we do, America will be greater than ever. Thank you, and may God bless you and the United States of America.
There's your fight song. Now to our Week in Review panel. First of all, the Democratic nominee is a woman, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Let's start with that little fact. What does that mean to you?
I'm with Michelle Obama on this one. I mean, I think that there's a moment here that we, you know, you can overdo it, you can underdo it, but you should definitely mention it and give it its due. Because as Michelle Obama said in that amazing speech of hers, it's about the young kids, the young girls watching this, and whether Hillary Clinton wins or not in November, they know. They know now. They're watching this. They're absorbing this. And they know that a woman can have all the jobs that they've already been told, but this one too.
Yeah, they've already been told, Zeki. Have we moved past the point where an actual woman being the nominee, that so it happened? We knew it would happen. It did happen. Are we past the point where that's important now?
Of course it's important. I don't know what took so long. But for me, when I was watching yesterday and when Hillary came to the line and said, "I accept the nomination," I had no idea I was going to get that emotional. And I was tearing up. But all I can think about is my daughter, and that she, like Michelle Obama said, she's going to grow up in a world where a woman president would be something normal. She will never know a time when that wasn't possible. And that's extremely emotional and extremely important. I really wonder should she be successful, if that's going to be almost like a tipping point not that this will become normal, that it won't happen again. There's something called moral licensing, which is really interesting. That's, in a nutshell, that theory is, okay, now we've done that. Now we prove we're not sexist, so we're just going to go back to what we've done before. So I don't know if that's...
Think about what Hillary Clinton said about that as well. She said, you know, not only me, but one of the little girls that's right. Watching now, you're going to be next.
I think I failed to introduce Zeki Hamid, who's program director at Humanities Washington. Hi,
Hello.
Zeki. Good to have you back. He's sitting next to Rob McKenna, former Attorney General of Washington State. Rob, whether you vote for Hillary Clinton or not, how significant is her gender to you?
I think it is significant, and just like it was significant that Barack Obama was elected as the first person of color to become president. There's no doubt that this is an important election in that regard. I wish that the first woman and first person of color we were electing president was Condoleezza Rice, but she disappointed a lot of us by choosing not to run several years ago. And that really goes to the heart of the matter, which is you have to have candidates. You know, it's great to think of having a person from a certain background elected to president, but first you've got to run. And Hillary has had more staying power than other women candidates, clearly, for the last couple of decades.
Joni, did last night's speech affect the November vote?
You know, we love to say that, you know, once a convention's over that, you know, you forget about it. But remember Bill Clinton's speech on behalf of Obama. Really, everybody was still talking about that many months later. I think the convention overall affects November because, as you know, from the Republican convention, which now seems like a couple hundred years ago, there was a Trump bounce.
In the polls.
I fully expect there will be an even bigger bounce because this was simply a better convention. Uplifting. I mean, it affected people. It was just wonderfully produced, this event. That's why you're still playing the music the next day. You just can't get over it kind of thing. But, yeah, I think there are some words.
It is my fight song.
It is your fight song. Yeah, nobody's doubting that. But I think that there are some takeaways. I mean, oddly, like someone like Michael Bloomberg, just an independent coming in and speaking on behalf of this candidate. There'll be some part of one of the speeches that becomes something that lasts.
Let's ask a Republican, Rob, did last night's speech and did the convention, maybe there's a bounce in the polls, maybe it fades. Did it affect the November vote, you think?
You know, I think that's an empirical question. I agree with Joni. We need to see what the post-convention polling looks like. In the middle of the convention, it did not appear that Senator Clinton was getting a bounce. As a matter of fact, Trump's numbers actually went up, which is highly unusual. So I think we'll have
Trump's numbers go up when anything happens.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, that's a very good point.
When he links up with the Russians, his poll numbers like, seem to go.
Right. God. But look, the fact is we got a long way to go until November, and you know, bounces are like dead cats. Sometimes it's just that one bounce. Mm. And so I think given how testy the American electorate is, we have a long way to go to know how this is going to turn out, even though I still have a hard time imagining that Trump is actually going to be able to win this election.
Zeki Hameed, what do you give you the word on that? What did the convention achieve after it's over?
Yeah, a couple of things that were really amazing to me. One is the diversity. Every time the camera would go across the audience and you see this amazing coalition of people coming together, a picture that truly looked like America. So that was one thing that really struck me. And if for anybody who wonders why we, people from Muslim backgrounds or Arabs, tend to vote Democratic, that's your answer right there, because they look like us. But the other thing is, all of a sudden, the Democratic Party takes the moniker of patriotism and family values, things that the Republicans have been, you know, talking about for decades, and they reclaim that in a way, maybe not reclaim that, but take that moniker, at the same time putting forth what is arguably the most progressive agenda that we've seen in decades. So it was, what a switcheroo in a kind of way. It was kind of, you know, but I was really struck by that.
We think about candidates moving toward the middle in the general election. That's the conventional wisdom. But there was a list of proposals on minimum wage and equal pay and government health care and free college.
All of that in at the same time where they're saying we are the party of family values, we are the party of patriotism. That has worked against Democrats for so long. And I thought that was kind of striking.
Well, one way you could tell that the Democrats sort of like who stole my convention. And you could tell this because Donald Trump's reaction last night or this morning was to be mad at the GOP because the Democrats were getting higher ratings. The thing he cannot, some things he can handle, some things
not
he
that.
Can't.
Yeah.
Not higher ratings for the Democrats.
I think what we saw in the convention was the expected move tacking back towards the center while they had this platform which included all of the ideas that you just mentioned, Bill, that that they needed to have to satisfy the base, to satisfy the activists. But the fact is, most of the messaging from the convention really tended to tack back towards the center. I thought that was especially noticeable in Tim Kaine's speech, where he talked about being a person of faith, about going to a Jesuit high school, et cetera. You know, I go to a lot of events that are dominated by Democrats, and there's really good people at nonprofit events, or I go to political events featuring Democrats now, and I've never heard anyone offer a prayer at the beginning of the meeting, which is a very common thing to see at Republican events. So I always felt that the Democrats are really downplaying faith, and it seemed to me that in Kaine's speech, they were making a conscious effort to appeal to people of faith by having him emphasize his own Catholic roots.
And that's why they picked him as well. Yeah. He's appealing to that swath
right.
of America. Absolutely.
I want to talk about faith of a kind. I want to talk about the faith of idealism and realism, because our state, Washington, went for Bernie Sanders in the caucuses big time. In Philadelphia, those Sanders delegates and other Sanders delegates, they booed, they chanted, they staged walkouts, they got scolded by comedian Sarah Silverman, a Bernie Sanders supporter herself.
To the Bernie or bust people, you're being ridiculous.
Zeki, if Bernie Sanders represents your ideals and Hillary Clinton isn't good enough for you, and you go to a political convention and refuse to act like it's a campaign ad for the nominee, are you being ridiculous, or are you, as you said, are you being entitled?
Yes, I said that some Bernie Sanders supporters are seem that they are entitled.
What does that mean?
I'll explain. So I don't think, first of all, it's a bad thing for them to go and express their ideas vocally in other ways, protest. That is definitely what democracy can be about. However, you have to choose when and how to do it. To walk out at right after the roll call of a historic moment, I think, is inappropriate.
Isn't that a statement? It's supposed to be dramatic. You do it at a dramatic moment.
I guess, but I just thought it was inappropriate to be doing that part. They've been doing it all convention long. It's not lost on anybody that they are really, really upset. And they were shouting, booing people and shouting a lot of vulgarities and stuff like that. And I just thought that what I mean by entitled is you have a race and you lose. That is part of life. It seemed to me that they... a lot of them, at least, not all of them, but some of them, I'll say that, some of them, it seemed that they have expected something to happen, something to be given to them. And when it didn't happen, they couldn't accept that idea. I've been around for a few elections. I became a citizen in 2001, so I've been voting ever since. I didn't vote for George W. Bush. I didn't agree with his politics. But when he lost, I didn't think it was the end of the world. And I didn't say, that's it. I'm out of the process. You keep going. And
but they're in the process. They're just taking a moment with America watching to say, we're better than this. And yes, Joni.
Well, one fun fact, Hillary Clinton got 3.7 million more votes than Bernie Sanders. So that is something they have to accept. To me, it seemed like a symphony.
Who's to say they don't accept it?
Well, they're demonstrating that they're still unhappy.
Yes.
But a couple things. So to me, it sort of strikes me as like a symphony, and they were like the percussion section or something like that. So here, everybody, the music's being made, and they're over there kind of pounding on the drums a little bit. That's democracy, right? But also, the thing that some of them must be missing is how impactful Bernie Sanders was. He said, this is the most progressive platform. Every speaker, just all the very many key speakers, feel the burn, says Tim Kaine. Obama, everybody, Hillary Clinton, acknowledged him over and over again. He was brought in. His ideas are there. Sometimes when you're the outsider, that's the impact that you have. That's the impact he had. He had a big, huge, huge impact.
Right. And a lot of people said that they have listened to Bernie Sanders, and they have listened to his supporters. You know, Hillary Clinton went and said, I hear you, I see you. But for these protesters, I mean, God forbid you just stick around and hear something without staging something else. I mean, if you are going to be convinced, you have to first listen. And I didn't think that they were doing that.
Rob, any disagreement?
I just want to thank the Bernie supporters at the convention for making it clear to all of us that Hillary is an anagram for liar. They took they took her signs, the vertical signs, and rearranged the lettering.
Yes, and also in Stronger Together, they took out certain letters and part of a letter R and made stop her.
And I think some people say that's because they're particularly upset over the emails that were hacked and what that revealed about the DNC's apparent favoritism towards Hillary Clinton. But, you know, to some extent, it was just being childish, right? There was like, we're not going to get our way, so we're going to make this as uncomfortable for everybody else as well. Losers. What's the anagram for sore losers? Right?
There you go. Start working on that one.
But they didn't set fire to anything. It seems like the assumption is that a political convention this is a modern assumption. I interviewed someone this week about how conventions didn't used to be campaign ads, and delegates didn't used to be props. This is their chance to democratically, they can hold signs, they can boo, they can walk out and say, as I said, we're better than this.
Yeah, they interrupted the infomercial, that's for sure.
Definitely. So suddenly everybody's a strategist. You know, you're being ridiculous because you're interrupting the infomercial, which Sarah Silverman's right too, but...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's like they have a right to make all the noise they want, to wear the neon shirts to show they still have something to say. But don't forget, they're getting about 80% of what they want in Hillary Clinton. And Sarah Silverman has a right to say to me, longtime Bernie supporter, I'm listening to you. She was filling airtime at that point. And she says, you just seem ridiculous. So that is the debate. That's our democracy.
Are we assuming that Americans are less likely to vote Clinton because Sanders delegates booed and chanted and held up signs? Is that the assumption? Are they somehow handing the presidency to Donald Trump by doing that?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you look at the polling.
So what's the worst they're doing?
I mean, if you look at the polling, about 16% of Hillary supporters in 2008 said they will not vote for John McCain. And true to that, when it came to elections, about 16% of her supporters did not vote for Barack Obama. The number now is about 8-9%. So I don't think it's going to matter unless Donald Trump wins by one percentage point or less. If he does, then you say, yes, they've had an impact.
But that'll also have to do with who votes for the Libertarian and all the other numbers.
We've seen that before. People who voted for Ralph Nader made it possible for George Bush to beat Al Gore. So it can make a difference at the margin. And one of the effects...
But not in Washington State, unless you think that Washington's a purple state in this election.
I have a hard time imagining that Bernie Sanders, even though he won the Democratic primary here earlier this year, would win in this state. I mean, he's not far to the left for a lot of Democrats, but looking at the state as a whole, remembering that...
So then get your Jill Stein on, right?
Yeah. I just think that what the demonstrations succeeded in doing was making it a little more... sort of normalizing the idea that you can stay with Bernie and not support Hillary. And that's the danger to the Hillary campaign, is that they're socializing the idea that we should cast a protest vote and not vote for Hillary by sticking with our guy Bernie.
And one of the things I saw was Seattle City Council member Shalma Sawant, who is not a Democrat, wanting people to walk out of something she doesn't belong to by her own description of herself.
Maybe independents and conservatives look at the dissension and say, wow, Hillary's not so liberal after all. Apparently, the Democrats think she's conservative. Maybe I could go Hillary.
You know, there's a... I want to mention something about ethics in terms of this voting. So there is a philosopher at Georgetown University. His name is Jason Brennan. He wrote a book called The Ethics of Voting. So in that, he argues that fervent idealism, no matter what the consequences are, is immoral. And I find that really fascinating. So what he says is the purpose of voting is not to express your fidelity to a worldview. It's not to wave a flag or paint your face in team colors, but it's to produce outcomes. So there are two schools of thought. There is a utilitarian approach to this, which says that the best action produces the maximum amount of good for the maximum amount of people. So you have an eye towards political consequences. And then there's another school of thought, the deontological thought, which says that the action itself, rather than the consequences, has moral value. So people, when they go to vote, this is not just I'm going to go and see who matches my ideals, whatever, and I'm going to cast a vote. There are ethics involved here. This is a very big decision. So for me, whenever I am going to cast a vote, I fall under the first school of thought there, where I have an eye towards the consequences, and I tend to choose who is going to do the most good. And that applies for anything. I mean, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, and I wasn't a big fan of Romney, but if I had both of them there, absolutely my vote would go to Romney. I'm not going to put a protest vote forward because I want what's best for my...
Right, you're not one of these, I cannot write, vote for that name. No, it's a choice between this and this, and you'll vote for... even if it's the lesser of the two evils.
Yes, that's what I call patriotism.
Yeah, so that gets back to the original question, I think, when Sarah Silverman is saying you're being ridiculous. Because how do you know when you're being idealistic? And, we tell our... What does every movie and every song say? You don't give up. You don't give up and give in. We're better than this. I'm going to stay idealistic. And when are you pragmatic and when are you a sellout? To me, that's the... And that could be beyond the convention and beyond politics. How do you know?
It's a tough question. It's a tough question, and you have to really wrestle with that. And that's when you have to engage in critical thinking. And, of course, being a humanities guy, that's where the humanities come in. They can help you with that, with that decision. But it's important.
Well, to your point about, that you should be voting for the outcome and the long-term vision of things, I mean, what's interesting about this election... And it was read a piece in the New York Times today about this. Nothing has so strengthened and united the Democrats as Donald Trump. And in fact, many people this election are voting much differently than you are saying. They are voting against someone. They are out saying, it's that I can't handle that outcome, so I'll accept this outcome.
All right, more to come. Rob, anything to... Did we nail it?
Yeah, I think
I'm inviting listeners to think about the questions that we're raising in their own lives, whether it's about politics or not, when they're holding fast and when they're giving up.
Well, look, the best argument I've heard advanced by supporters of Trump who don't like Trump is that, we don't like him, we're going to hold our nose and vote for him because there's some decisions that are going to be made by the next president which will last for decades, particularly appointments to the United States Supreme Court. And that's probably the best argument they have for holding your nose and voting for Trump. But for some of us, we just can't bring ourselves to vote for someone we find so repugnant.
Yes, that's the anti-Zeki argument. You're saying, no, I can't do it, even if it's the pragmatic, better outcome thing to do.
Yeah, but it does create a real quandary, and it's it's at the heart of the upset among many establishment Republicans like myself that we had so many good candidates to choose from. We had, it was often said, an embarrassment of riches among our candidates, and now we just have an embarrassment.
But let's go to your embarrassment for one second. I do want to ask you, so was that, let the democracy roll? There's 17 candidates. They have, I heard, 200 years of experience if you added them all together, or a lack of discipline, as we were talking about in the green room on the part of your party.
Yeah, it's more of a lack of discipline. I think we've become the party that Will Rogers referred to in the 1920s. He famously said, "I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat." And now that seems to be more true of the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, we're fractured into three big camps: the Tea Party people, the establishment Republicans, and the Trump populists. So it is a problem. I mean, we've lived through this before locally when we had a very crowded field for governor in 1996. That allowed Ellen Craswell, who was very far to the right. To become the nominee. And she actually did better than people expected. I think she got like 44-45% of the
vote. I thought it was 41.
41. I'll trust your memory to that. But it was in the 40s, but it wouldn't have happened if we had had some discipline to keep such a crowded field from materializing. Democrats are doing better than that right now.
It was very crowded that year as well,
it was dominated by Locke and was it Don Bonker? Was his principal?
You're listening to Norm Politics Talk.
Norm Rice, yeah.
On KOW.
History lesson.
Okay, listeners, we've laid out the big questions of life for you. Now it's up to you to go figure it out. Week in Review will continue. We've got a little more politics in us. We've also got some Vulcans and some bugs, so don't go away. This is KUOW's Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Joni Balter, Zeki Hamid. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW, and we're reviewing and learning from the week's news. Right now, we want to talk about a few days from now. 4 days away, the Washington State primary comes Tuesday with races for U.S. Senate, Congress, governor, state legislature. You'll find all our election coverage at KUOW.org. For a few minutes, I want to focus on one race on your ballot. We have always thought of the job of lieutenant governor as mostly ceremonial. The lieutenant governor is the one who physically signs all the new laws that are passed. It's a rubber stamp. It's a formality. Except one of the candidates now, Bellevue State Senator Cyrus Habib, says if he's lieutenant governor, he won't sign any law that doesn't advance the goal of fully funding our state's public schools. That's not ceremonial. That sounds powerful, Rob McKenna. Can he do that?
Well, he's gotten into a very public fight with the current lieutenant governor, Democrat Brad Owen, over this very issue. And Governor Owen, we call lieutenant governor governor, has said, look, when you sign the statement that the bill has passed, all you're really doing is validating that it received the necessary number of votes to pass. It's a ministerial function, in other words. And it would be inappropriate to use that as a tool to surface policy disagreements. That's not what the lieutenant governor is there to do at that moment. Now, Senator Habib responds to that by saying, well, there was a time when Governor Owen refused to sign a bill because he thought it was unconstitutional. But that was really a different situation, I think. It had to do with not satisfying the two-thirds requirement, and there was a goal to create a test case for the Supreme Court. What Senator Habib is articulating is a much broader principle that he can use his power as lieutenant governor, this ministerial role, for political purposes. For example, when he decides for himself, well, I don't think this bill is constitutional because this funding that it provides is not adequate under the McCleary decision. I think that's wrong, and I think, frankly, it's irresponsible. It's not his job to decide the constitutionality of an act, even though he's a lawyer. He's not a judge. If he wants to decide constitutionality, he should go put on a black robe and run for the Supreme Court instead.
Does he have the letter of the law on his side? If he doesn't write his name on that law, it's not a law?
Well, he's saying there's a way around that. I forget there's a technical way they can get around it if he doesn't sign it, which I think makes it even less impressive and more of a political stunt for him to say, I won't sign bills. Now, we know why he did it. He was referring to the McCleary decision to education funding. This was part of his campaign.
This is the state Supreme Court saying that the state's got to up the money it spends on schools.
To fully fund basic education, yeah, instead of shuffling the responsibility off onto local school districts, which they've been doing. But Senator Habib was clearly aiming for an endorsement from the Washington Education Association.
That's who he was speaking to when this all came down.
Exactly.
It seems like a little bit of hyperbole.
It definitely was. But he didn't expect such a pointed critique from the sitting lieutenant governor when he did it. And that has, I don't know if it's, what do you think, Joni? Has it been good or bad for Habib?
Well, it makes him so very committed to education funding so that, you know, people are going to know, you know, we're talking about low information race, low information voters. I mean, people are going to know almost nothing about this race when they vote. And this is, isn't he the one that's really into, you know, fully funding education? When in fact, when he gets into the office, he will not be able to do that unless he can somehow convince Governor Inslee to go on vacation for like a week or two and be gone so that he's the one who must sign the bill. And then I guess he can apply all this. But Lieutenant Governor doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. So in the bigger picture, sure, Zeki, do we just want the lieutenant governor to be something the governor appoints, since apparently none of us know enough to elect? Yeah. Joni just said nobody knows about who they're voting for.
That's probably
brilliant.
Yeah, it's probably
you could,
a good idea.
You could make that argument about a lot of our statewide offices. We could be like New Jersey and only have one statewide elected official, the governor, who appoints everybody.
Who wants to be like New Jersey?
Exactly. I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah.
How does it work
there,
though?
Do you have any other things about Jersey that you haven't told us?
Let me tell you about Jersey.
Do they like it that way in Jersey?
You know, it's what they've had. It dates back to the fact that it was, you know, one of the original colonies, and they had a royal governor. In fact, do you know who the last royal governor of New Jersey was? Benjamin Franklin's son. Who was a committed Tory. It's a really interesting story. But that's their history, right? That's what they're used to. In the West, we're used to electing everybody. I mean, every judge is elected in this state. We elect the...
And sometimes that makes absolutely no sense.
But try to change it. Try to change that and ask the voters to amend the Constitution to change these offices away from being elected, and they'll say no. They think it creates more accountability to have elected officials, including the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and seven other statewide offices.
Yeah, we love...
We love to have a voice in every single little thing, like the initiative system and all of that. I'm a big fan of representative democracy, which means I would elect the legislature, but I want you to do the job and not reflect it back on me to make that decision. But we love to have our hand in everything, which really doesn't make sense, because especially when we're voting on judges, I think of myself as a politically savvy guy, but I don't know anything about judges. And so you're asking me to make a very big decision that I'm just uncomfortable making.
Right. You're telling me to micromanage elected office, and I'm terrible at it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's my job as a voter.
I'm fine with all this if people do the work to be informed, read the newspapers, listen to KOW.
Listen to KOW, 94.9 FM.
That's
news
what I was
going to
say.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was going to say. And, you know, if you're willing to be informed and do the work to know all of this stuff, fine. But the insisting that you vote on everything without knowing it, it's a little funny that way, right?
We're actually, what I want to talk about, by the way, our election coverage is all at KUOW.org, so you can go to the web too. We, you know what else we hover over without necessarily being good at it? Our children. We're going to take that up.
For yourself,
and some of, stay tuned to the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Zeki Hamid is Program Director at Humanities Washington. Rob McKenna was your Attorney General here in Washington State. And we are reviewing the news of the week and learning something from it on the Week in Review. Vulcan is moving into the CD. Paul Allen's real estate company bought the Red Apple Market. You all know the Red Apple, right? On 23rd and Jackson, historically the center of Seattle's African-American community, which is now scattering. Before Vulcan starts developing the block, the company sat down with the community to show their designs and give people a say. And this is delicate. A lot of black people have left the Central District because financially they had no choice. This is a resident named Anita Adams.
There's a lot of legacy here for me. And will my children be able to come back to this community at some point and see their relevance and feel invited and feel welcomed and have fond memories of this is where I grew up? That's what's bittersweet about it for me.
And how would those children feel invited? And how will the new 23rd and Jackson be redeveloped and not become a Goliath of money and white privilege? KUOW's Joshua McNichols told us about Vulcan's plans to keep the project to scale.
One thing that Vulcan has there is sort of a staircase of commercial spaces. Like, you've got some spaces for tiny kiosks that could operate on the sidewalk. Then you've got some, like, smaller or a little bit bigger spaces that they could move into as their business grows. And then a little bit of a medium-sized commercial space where they could move up into after that. So there's this idea that maybe they could foster businesses and help them develop in their growth. And that could apply to some of the minority-owned businesses in the central area. Also, they presented some inspirational images of African art that they thought could influence the way the building looks. For example, they put up an African wedding blanket in one of the slides and said, look at some of the geometry here. Maybe we could incorporate this in some way into the texture and the ornamentation of the building.
And whether that's inspirational will be in the eye of the beholder. First of all, does Vulcan owe anything to the minority-owned businesses, the small businesses, and the African-American residents and former residents? Zeki?
I don't think they owe them anything, but it's an issue of morals. It's an issue of ethics. Are you going to be ethical about it or not? So in terms of do they owe them? No, anybody can do anything, I guess, in a certain way.
But what is ethical here?
Well, the ethical thing is to do what they're doing, is to consult the community. You can't just go and not you can, you can, but I don't think it's appropriate to go into a community, completely change it without consulting the people who have lived there for generations. So I'm really glad that they're doing that. I don't know what their intentions are. We usually tend to distrust businesses, and especially big businesses. That's just kind of part of our moral fabric in a certain way. I guess it doesn't really matter what their intentions are or why they're doing it, as long as they are doing it and they are consulting with this community and trying to keep the community the way it is. And I really applaud that.
You're right. We do scan people and businesses for their intentions beyond their actions. Is that appropriate and useful, Rob?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing for Vulcan to be doing, just because it's the right thing to do and it's respectful of that community. And I think that a lot of African American business owners, according to KOW's reporting, are grateful for that, and they appreciate it. They don't have to do it, but they're choosing to do it, not even necessarily because they need to from a business point of view, because I don't know how many of their customers will really notice, but the people who are already there definitely will notice. And I think it's a pretty good example for Vulcan to be setting that other developers ought to take note of.
So, look, our city is changing so fast, most people can't keep up with it. The Central District is changing like crazy. Gentrification, a lot of people are moving out of the neighborhood, as you said. I think it's smart public relations for Vulcan to do this. You know, Vulcan is associated with many of the changes, love them or hate them, at South Lake Union. And so here they're coming into a neighborhood. Years ago, the whole issue was, could you get anybody to invest in this neighborhood? But now it's a close-in neighborhood. City's changing really fast. I think it's a smart move for the company to do. I think the way that we should sort of view it long-term is, how long-term is this commitment? Are they going to have these kiosks that they're referring to, you know, for 1 year, 2 years, for how long? How long are they going to stay stitched to the community that has been there for such a long time?
But you don't think there's anything unethical about Vulcan redeveloping a property that will be another piece of making a neighborhood less affordable? Not a conflict.
Well, no, I guess it would be a conflict as well. So again, these are really, really tough issues, and they don't have simple answers. And that's why we hold these meetings, public meetings, to talk about all of this.
Well, neighborhoods, including the central area, which I've spent a fair amount of time in part because one of my daughters lived there for about 3 years while she was a student at Seattle U. Neighborhoods need reinvestment. You know, buildings crumble, infrastructure breaks down, businesses can't survive without customers. So you need reinvestment, and that means reinvestment from private capital sources. And that's what Vulcan is doing here. I mean, they probably see this as a cutting-edge move because, as Joni points out, the area is rapidly changing over, the housing is being replaced and so forth. But the businesses there will do better with something that's newer and attractive and brings customers, after all, to them. Vulcan is in a partnership with its tenants, right? It needs its tenants to be successful, and I think they see this as a way to help make their tenants, the small businesses, more successful.
Right.
What about the design element? When has it ever worked to incorporate a nod, a kind of design nod, to the history of people who can no longer afford to be there because of development like yours? You see the quandary. The design.
I have a great example of the opposite of that, which in it involved Vulcan as well, when they tried to build the Seattle Commons. They tried to bring the whole city into the idea that there would be a park in the middle of the South Lake Union neighborhood, and the voters twice said no. Mm-hmm. But it was an attempt at that time to bring, this was sort of a low-slung neighborhood. The Seattle Times was there where I worked for a long time. And they wanted to give it amenities that people would then buy into their obviously huge development plans for that area.
I'm talking about the atmospherics of incorporating the design element of, as Joshua said, an African wedding blanket. It's pretty tough to pull that off and make it seem like a nod to the culture and the history of a neighborhood, as opposed to a tone-deaf plaque in memoriam of the people who can't afford to live here anymore. Any thoughts on that?
I think this is a very creative approach. In most communities that have a longer history, the way you preserve the history is by preserving the buildings. So, for example, I was in Columbus, Ohio not long ago. They have an area called Germantown or German Village, and it's all these old brick houses and brick buildings that have been there for 150 years. So the way you preserve the history there, even as it redevelops, is you preserve those structures. You take care of the brick, etc. Here you've got buildings that aren't that valuable, and so you can't really do it by maintaining a lot of historic architecture because it doesn't exist. Most of it is, you know, a little bit before, a little bit after World War II. So instead, they look for cultural elements and try to fold those into the community, into the design, to the architecture, to honor the history of the area, even as the area is changing. And I think that's a really cool thing for them to be doing.
Final words before we go?
Yeah, I believe in private enterprise, and I believe in a partnership between the public and the private sector, and this is something I think that is a very good idea.
Coming up on The Week in Review, hovering over your children and eating your bugs. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, this week with Rob McKenna, Joni Balter, and Zeki Hamid. This week you heard an interview with the founder of a website called Free Range Kids. Lenore Scanese told you that today's parents are hovering over our children and not letting them figure out how to live.
What you want is your kid to grow up with some kind of soul where they sort of know right from wrong, and they do it and they learn to do it because they're part of society, not because somebody is watching from above like a jailer or a parent or God telling them, you know, you can't do that. No, I can do that better for you. I would make a better decision. That's not a decision you should be making.
Well, one of our listeners objected to that logic. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, is here. Bon, what did he say?
So Dennis said a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what he said is that past generations, or generations preceding mine at least, have grown up free range, but that doesn't necessarily make them better people. I quote, teenagers and 20-somethings of today are the best educated Americans in recorded history. Compared with Gen X and baby boomers, they have lower rates of drug and alcohol abuse, fewer teen pregnancies, abortions, STDs. They have lower rates of incarceration. And
lower SAT scores, says the boomer.
Let the listener finish, boomer.
You.
So entitled.
He goes on to say they end up dead less often, whether from crime and violence or accidents like bicycle or car crashes. He finishes, there is no consistent evidence that something is going wrong with the way young people today are being raised.
So the hovering worked, right?
Well, he's saying that because there's this idea that, you know, I was raised this way and I turned out okay. Oh, what's so great about how you turned out? Basically, is what this listener is saying. Anybody disagree?
Well, I think a lot of us who are boomers, you know, worry about our kids not playing outside, that they don't go out. That's what we think of. A lot of us, I've been in a number of conversations the last couple of years, people about my age, and we all talk about how our rule was, our parents' rule for us was, we had to be home when the streetlights came on.
Exactly.
And
yep.
and that is a completely foreign concept. I mean, maybe the fact that we have streetlights that come on is a foreign concept to some kids. But look at what's happened in the last couple of weeks. After 8 years of Michelle Obama telling us to get our kids off the couch and outside and not really succeeding at doing that, Pokemon Go has got our kids off the couch uh-huh. and outside. And Pokemon has got, you know, 300 kids at the Bellevue Downtown Park being chased away at 11 o'clock at night by the cops. So it
the lights are coming on.
And we just weren't using the right technique. So I don't care what it takes, but I do think getting kids outside and socializing more is a good thing. And I fully admit as completely my bias because, God darn it, that's the way I was raised. It must
right.
be the right way.
Joni, any thoughts?
Well, so I have, you know, some guilt about this, but also another side to it, which
guilt
is—
guilt because you hover?
Oh, I hover. Yeah. But also, as a working parent, how much hovering did I actually do since I was working 10, 12 hours a day?
Yeah.
So it's kind of an interesting mixture. So somebody, there were hired hoverers, there were neighbor hoverers.
Yes.
But, you know, we hover and we get involved, and yet we were gone a lot.
Right.
These kids had plenty of range, and I don't know if the streetlights were on or off some days.
I don't know what hovering exactly means, really. I mean, if you want to define hovering, I mean, I grew up in Amman, Jordan, and we were out all the time, you know, by ourselves. But then again, it was different than a neighborhood. I don't really know many of my neighbors, and I've been in that neighborhood for almost 5 years. But back in Jordan, we knew everybody.
Right. Why don't you know your neighbors?
You seem like such a friendly guy.
Yeah.
I do know them, but I mean, at least on my street. I know everybody on my street, but beyond that, I don't know. And it's a hard thing for me. And then again, my daughter's not very old. She'll be 3 years old in October. So, of course, I'm frightened. You know, I don't want her to get out of my sight if we're, you know, at a playground, stuff like that. And I don't know if that's justified or not. It's got to be some kind of middle ground. I'm not going to let my kid just go off by herself. And at the same time, I don't want to just be following her every step.
Here's the middle ground. It's sports. It gets you outside, usually, unless it's like rainy basketball. But most of the sports, the soccer, the baseball,
organized
the football,
sports like me.
Yeah, organized. They get you outside.
Okay.
Yeah, what about kick? What about kick?
Plenty of referees and parents to hover over you.
Exactly right. It has its place. There's no question about it. And I don't mean to suggest that kids are isolated, because I think kids are more connected than ever in history. I mean, I see that in my own the two younger ones of my four, who are online all the time, connected with their friends in a way it would have been literally impossible for us to achieve. So I don't think that's a problem. I do look at objective data, though, and also anecdotes from people like college counselors, admissions counselors and others, who talk about helicopter parents and talk about, and I hear my own daughters talk about college age men who they've been around the last several years.
And they said
that these guys are experiencing significant delayed development in many cases, that they're and they're friends, and they talk about this a lot, that young men today appear to be delayed in their development. And one of the supposed causes is helicopter parenting that doesn't force them to grow up some or grow up more.
Yes, a supposed cause. Let me wrap it up there, because our listener, who we paraphrased, did talk about exactly anecdotes like that. And he's saying, those are anecdotes. Let's look at some numbers. You've got to prove that this generation is soulless and spineless and ruined by helicoptering. Don't just claim it. But anyway, you can talk amongst yourselves. We're tweeting at KUOW. You can write to us, record@KUOW.org. You know, one of the worst things that could happen, your kid could be out of your sight and eat a bug. And what would be so bad about that? Coming up. KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. This is the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook, David George Gordon, told you if you want to do the right thing for the environment, for the world, you should be eating bugs.
Well, there are lots of reasons, and the UN came out with a report through the Food and Agriculture Organization about 4 years ago that really laid it out. This is like a 180-page report, so it wasn't a little pamphlet. In it, they talked about all the environmental benefits, you know, raising crickets is way less wasteful than raising cattle. It takes thousands of gallons of water to get a pound of steak. And these days, water is precious, so that's kind of a giant waste. We can get the same amount of protein from raising crickets, and they also don't require nearly as much food. The amount of food that goes through a cow is shocking. And something like 12 pounds of grain will get you 1 pound of meat. With crickets, it's more like 2 pounds of grain will get you 1 pound of meat. They have all these amazing vitamins and minerals, things you wouldn't get elsewhere, vitamin B12. Vegetarians or vegans have a real issue with vitamin B12, which is only available through living things. Things like calcium, all the omega-3 fatty acids you'd normally get from eating salmon. So there's all sorts of those reasons to eat bugs. But also the reason the Food and Agriculture Administration got into this. The way our population on this planet is growing, they're projecting that by 2040, there'll be another billion people sharing our resources. Those people couldn't all eat hamburgers if they wanted to. Most of our production lands are already in use. So the FAO is actually looking at alternative protein sources and recognizing that 80% of the world's cultures already do eat bugs. They are urging people to start farming as opposed to wild harvesting and eating more bugs.
And that is why you should eat bugs. Does anyone disagree with that?
Hell yeah.
Go ahead,
you do?
Zaki.
Well, I just want to say, I know David George Gordon. He's a speaker at our Speakers Bureau at Humanities Washington, and I've seen his presentation, which is fantastic. For anybody out there, if you want to see his presentation, it's really worth it. Just go to our website, humanities.org, look up, you know, he'll be all over the calendar in the fall, all over the state. So he's great. He's extremely entertaining.
But does yes.
But I would say there is an alternative if you want you know, the ethics of eating meat and all that. Just be vegetarian, like I am.
He just told you don't get enough B12.
I disagree.
You seem like you're down.
Wait a minute.
You're down on B12 for me for some reason.
A vegetarian won't eat meat. You won't eat crickets either.
You know, I did try a bar that he gave me, like a power bar made with cricket flour.
Yeah.
It gave me heartburn, and it just lasted with me all night. It was not my cup of tea.
Chimney cricket.
Rob, you heard the reasons why you got to eat bugs, and you're still not going to do it?
Well, you know, it's just a matter of a visceral reaction. I'm suddenly sympathetic or empathetic maybe to vegetarians who recoil at the idea of eating meat. because that's exactly the physical reaction I'm having to the idea of eating.
Yeah, well, let's let you get over that.
Oh,
right,
look at
now,
what he's doing. Oh,
I happen to bring a little something that's surprisingly hard to open. Okay, these, and I just, you saw me open the pack. I haven't eaten them either. Those are crickets. They look like crickets.
Oh,
I have a plate of crickets.
Do they have little top hats and spats?
they do. No. They do a dance.
Look, they're with bugs. Okay, I've never done this before.
All right.
Right now, these are dehydrated salted crickets.
Pass them around.
They're not particularly good, but it's not a big deal.
All right, I'm a vegetarian, right, but I'm going to try it.
Okay. So I've eaten bugs before in the
eat up, Zeki.
Chocolate covered ants.
Yeah.
My brother, you used to be able to get these at like the trick store.
Yeah.
You could buy chocolate covered.
For the record, they actually look like crickets. Couldn't they have like made them not look like crickets?
I was going to say, where's the chocolate?
I'm going to help you in just
a moment. Where's the chocolate that covers this?
Rob is eating it. Zeki, you good?
Mm-hmm. A little bit like sunflower seeds.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they taste like sunflower seeds. You're right.
They're nutty. Joni, are you okay? You're not fainting, right?
No.
Okay.
No. I'm not raving either while we're at it, but you know.
Right. They're not that great.
They could use
that's
a little more
thing.
Salt. Maybe more
somebody
salt.
Somebody who says this is
a lot
best.
Of salt. That's
sriracha.
I don't trust somebody who says that this is going to change your life. Bugs are so fantastic. But we're giving you the real truth, which is it's fine. You ate them. They look like bugs. They taste kind of nutty. They're not great. It's fine. So if that is a problem for any of you, because you're now bug eaters, right? Are you not?
We
did you
now.
Convert?
Evidently.
Because listen, Rob, you told me that you don't think you can get over it. I've got three choices for you. I've got a dark chocolate coffee cayenne.
See, if you add the chocolate, everything's good.
This is what I'm saying. This is a cricket powder, 15 to 20%. I bought all of this, by the way, on Lower Queen Anne at a place called Mark's Foods. You can too. And you've got a choice of peanut butter and chocolate, coconut, ginger, and lime, or dark chocolate, coffee, and cayenne. So,
the fact they're powdered does make a difference.
It does help.
Yeah,
it could
yeah.
Be
but looking at them right here, the little eyes and the little antenna.
Let's see.
You want to try it?
Here you go. Dark chocolate one. I don't like dark chocolate.
They're anatomically intact on our plate right
That
here.
Is the problem.
Listen to this. He'll eat
that
crickets,
is the problem.
But he won't eat dark chocolate.
I don't like dark chocolate.
All right.
That is the problem.
That's the dark
they do
somebody,
look exactly like
here.
What they are. That is the problem.
Yes. Yeah, so that's why I'm giving you these bars. I'm handing them out. There you go. Okay.
Whoa.
So what I want to tell the listener.
Here, you look like a chapul.
Listener who's following us, you can write to us. We're at Twitter right now, at KOW. Listener, either give me a good reason why you won't eat bugs, or I want you to immediately buy or order bugs and eat them and tell me about it. We're going to get over that. Eating bugs is just a matter of habit, right? It's just a matter of what you're used to, unless you're a vegetarian who won't eat crickets like Zeki.
But I am now, I guess.
See, you just ate it.
It's
so
crossed the
Is it really
line
a violation of being a vegetarian of eating bugs?
That's what I'm
so. Yeah. I really don't.
Okay, so he tried his best. Central Co-op on Capitol Hill, Mark's Foods on Lower Queen Anne. Markspantry.com or online. You can order at Amazon. I don't care. But either you don't want to eat bugs because you don't care about the environment and resources and everything he told you, or you're now going to eat bugs and we're going to get past this whole I don't eat bugs thing.
I can finally tell my daughter I ate bugs. I joke with her about that all the time.
It's like Hillary or Trump. It's one or the other. You got to vote now.
I'm going with the dream bug.
I'm voting for the crickets.
All right. I thought I was going to offer it to you, and it was going to be crickets. Yeah. Okay. Listen, final thought. Dick's Drive-Ins.
Zeki can't be stopped.
Dick's Drive-In now accepting credit cards.
The last reason to carry cash is disappeared.
Rob McKenna, former Attorney General of Washington State. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Zeki Hamid, Program Director, Humanities Washington. Thank you all for being on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm not making you eat tarantulas. Just try the bugs. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.